The subject of the outline, the material we'll be talking about, is addressed to ministers of the gospel, which in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod means not only the pastoral ministers, and I think probably the most of you are those, but if there are also called teachers in the audience, I would address the comments to those. Do we have any that are called teachers? One, okay. There may be lay people like myself here too, and for the most part, this is going to mean nothing at all to you. This is a clergy benefit, a special privilege under the tax laws. In addition to that, then, having identified that class of people, let me also be sure that you understand that we're talking about people not only to the extent that you've served the seminary during the past 3 years, and that's the period of time that we're looking at in particular, and of course the future years, but if you have also served in any other capacity as pastoral minister with any other college or seminary or any other part of the church, such as a district of the synod in 1976, 77, or last year, 1978, or so far this year in 79, I'm also addressing myself to you in that capacity. We will of necessity, of course, have to concentrate on the rules that the seminary has, but nevertheless, you should feel free to ask questions or make comments that might relate to prior employment during those years. So, with that, let's take a look at the memo. As I say, we'll go through this rather quickly. It'll pinpoint some important things, and then we'll open it up for the questions and comments. Point number one is that it is intended as a give-and-take session as to past taxes, and all of you are exposed to that possibility. Some of you may be giving to the government and others may be taking back. Beyond that, however, as to future policy and practice, I'll be giving you this information and then I'll be taking your suggestions and comments for use not only by the Board of Control of Concordia Seminary, but I've also agreed with Art Allschwede that we would examine present policy as it applies to Fort Wayne and to the colleges, and perhaps they will then gain from the kind of information and viewpoints that we are able to pick up from you today. As to past taxes, and I found it convenient to do it this way because I think you can as well concentrate on the issues on what you've done in the past. As to past taxes, I've broken it down between those of you who live in SEM-owned housing and those of you who do not, who live in apartments or in your homes that you own yourself. Obviously, again, when I talk about living in SEM-owned housing, if you've come out of a parish situation and a parsonage was furnished to you, think then in terms of having lived in a church-owned housing. You see what I'm saying? This is an easy area, and it is the origin of the provision of the tax law, that the value of the housing is not subject to income tax. I've said state or federal. I'd like it if you would make a note that when I say state, I can only talk about Missouri. I do not know that you have a similar privilege in Illinois if you live there or any other state that you might have lived in. But for Missouri and federal purposes, the value of that housing is simply not part of your taxable income. And you should recognize to begin with that this is a distinct clergy privilege not afforded to other people except in the rare case that the employee is living in employer-owned housing on the premises of the employer and for the convenience of the employer, which rarely is anything but like a night watchman or a guard or some such thing. Very few lay people, very few people other than clergymen have any kind of a benefit like this, that you're actually given compensation, but the government has seen fit to acknowledge that they won't pay charge taxes on it. So the value of the housing, for those of you who live here in seminary-owned housing, is not included in your taxable income. Now, here's a point which, as to past taxes, some of you could conceivably have missed an opportunity. In addition to the value of the housing, you can exclude from your cash salary a portion of the salary that you use for housing expenses. such as homeowners insurance premiums. I mean, by that, I mean if you own your own home, the standard fire and extended coverage, or if you live in an apartment, you usually have some kind of liability and contents coverage. I've just called it homeowners with quotes around it. Utilities and telephone other than long distance. New furnishings, furniture, routine maintenance and repairs, which you paid for. All of those things, if you spent money during the course of the last 1976 or afterwards, and can prove what you actually paid, you were entitled to take those amounts off your base cash salary before you began to compute your income tax, before you begin to take off deductions, whether they're standard deductions or itemized or whatever. And if you have not, we'll get into what you can do for those years to recover some taxes that you've already paid. Now, I do make the comment here, and it's important to remember, that although those amounts, including the value of your housing, are not part of your income tax, they are in fact a part of your Social Security or self-employment tax, which as clergymen you pay unless you've opted out for one of the legitimate reasons. So that means that when you sit down, if you would have a cash salary, you live in seminary-owned housing, you have a cash salary which is less than the current maximum amount on which self-employment taxes, Social Security taxes are paid, you have to add in the value of your housing, which probably at that point would take it up over the maximum, at least it would take it up close to the maximum. And that's a difficult thing. There are rules of thumb that you can apply. The law says the proper way of going about it is to know what the value of your housing is. So if you live in one of these houses over here, you ought to figure out what that house would rent for if it was renting on the open market. And you take that value over the course of the year, if you've been employed the whole year, add it to your cash salary as you figure your self-employment taxes. So two was the good news side of the point, and three is the bad news side of the point. Some of you may have been underpaying your self-employment tax during the past few years if you are getting cash lower than that maximum amount. The good news side of the bad news point is that the more that you pay into Social Security, the bigger your own earnings record is, and therefore you ultimately can increase the benefits to your wife or dependents if you should die before retirement or in your case of your own retirement. We won't get into all the pluses and minuses of the Social Security system if you don't mind, but I do point out that on the one side you have to pay a tax, and on the other side the benefits are determined according to how much you do pay in, what your own earnings records are. There's some involvement which I haven't put here on for Concordia plans purposes too. Well, unless there are questions or comments on that, I just won't go into that. Okay, now then we have the class of people who do not live in SEM-owned housing. In this case, you are entitled to exclude from your taxable compensation the lesser of, and I underlined it because it's so terribly important, the amount that you actually spend on housing and the percentage of cash compensation established by the Board of Control as a housing allowance. We'll take those two things piecemeal, looking at page two now. Your expenditures for housing may include rent payments if you rent a house or an apartment, principal and interest payments if you own your own home, insurance premiums on fire casualty, contents, liability, things like that on your home, whether you own or rent. Real estate taxes, that obviously would only apply if you own your own home. But note the parenthetical and be prepared to fend off any tax auditor or accountant that you may come in contact with. You are entitled to both exclude the income for real estate taxes and to deduct the real estate taxes on the schedule on which you, if you itemize deductions, you itemize taxes as a deduction. That's true incidentally, and you might want to make a similar note up there where it refers to interest payments. Interest also qualifies as to the exclusion, but likewise is a deduction. So not only do you get one benefit, unlike most taxpayers, you get a double dip. You get to exclude it and deduct the same amount. And you will probably, maybe some of you have, run into accountants who will say, absolutely not, it can't be so. And yet the Internal Revenue Service acknowledges that that is the case, and they do not make an issue of it. Okay, other expenses, utilities and phone charges again, excluding long distance. Utilities, remember, electric, gas, sewer, water, all of those kinds of charges that are furnished to your apartment or home that you actually pay for. Maintenance and repairs, new additions and remodeling. That's a, you go into a house that you buy and you renovate the kitchen. If you spend $1,000 or $2,000 putting in new cabinets and so forth, that, while that is a capital expenditure as far as your house is concerned, that has nothing to do with qualifying for the full amount of the housing allowance. It helps you qualify. So you have to be able to prove that you spent amounts for those kinds of payments. Then the other limitation is the amount that has been established by the board. Prior to August 1 of this year, am I correct on that? I may want to check that. I was looking.
Yes, right.
Okay. Prior to August 1 of this year, and I do not know whether it goes back all the way from 76 forward. It may have gone up at different stages, so you might want to put a little parentheses question mark here. But I know at least at August 1, 79, and for a period of time before then, it was 37.5% of your cash compensation, raised temporarily now at as of August 1 to 45%.
It was 37.5 only for about the last 3 years.
Okay, so that...
It was 35,
yeah.
I think, before John, do you recall?
Yes.
Okay, so there would be a part of 76, presumably, in which your percentage limitation would have been somewhat lower, and you'll want to watch that. Now, before I go on to the important note here and explain what that means, I want to tie this back to that part of the outline 2A that dealt with those of you who live in SEM-owned housing. That's the percentage allowed there is also available for those of you who lived in SEM-owned housing. It's almost impossible, I think, for anybody to spend 37.5% of their cash compensation for housing while they live in SEM-owned housing. You don't have maintenance, you don't have rent payments, you know, you just don't have that possibility. But nevertheless, the way this thing has been set up in the past, it has been technically possible. This will be one of the things that will be refined as we deal with the board this fall, to make sure that those of you who live in SEM-owned housing have a percentage, probably 7.5%, maybe higher, I can't predict that for sure, that will apply to your base salary. Now, the important note, and one of the things that really was the impetus for my coming out here, as Al Lindgren was wrapping things up earlier this year, we talked on the phone, and he was telling me about a couple of different resolutions. And in his mind, they seemed to be confused. At least as we were talking, we went back and forth, and we agreed that we ought to explore into the whole situation. He was telling me something I was unaware of before then, that there is a resolution that's apparently still a valid resolution of the BHE that tells colleges and seminaries of the Synod that in setting the salaries for faculty members, they ought to be sure in a formula way to include an amount for housing, and the figure that's been used, I think, during these past few years is $3,300. Now, all that means, and ever was intended to mean, is that as you look at the needs of your faculty members, remember that he's got a housing expense if he doesn't live in seminary-owned housing. So put $3,300 in there at least. That's, you know, kind of a rule of thumb. And then add the other things, and you come up with a base salary. That should never have, and I hope for none of you has, entered into your housing allowance. Because if you have a base salary, and let's go back to the old rate, let's assume you don't live in seminary-owned housing, you do own your own house, and you do spend 37.5% of your base salary, your cash salary for housing purposes. If that amount exceeds $3,300, you're entitled to exclude the full amount. You are not limited to the $3,300. And I'm afraid that in talking to Al, there is a possibility that just in the normal reporting, some of you could have been led to believe that you had perhaps three limitations: the amount of that you spent, the percentage, or $3,300, whichever is greater, and you have to knock out the $3,300. Conversely, for those of you, and here's the giving a little bit more to the government, not just taking it back, those of you who might have reported and taken the greater of what you spent, or the percentage, or $3,300, you owe the government some taxes. Again, as with the reference that I made back for those that lived in SEM-owned housing, you have to take this amount as you've determined it for exclusion purposes, income tax exclusion purposes. You have to include it for self-employment tax purposes and pay your self-employment tax accordingly. Now then, point three. My outline was not set up exactly where I wanted, just by the change of a period to a parentheses. Three was meant to be a part. One was give and take, two past taxes. Now three applying to everybody, not three parentheses, as though it's a part of that living in SEM-owned housing. Three is if you haven't taken full advantage of the housing allowance, you can file to obtain a refund of taxes. The procedure for doing so is to file an amended Form 1040. The time for doing it, and that's why I tied it back to 76, for those of you who might have taken less than what you were entitled to take in calendar 76, you must file your amended 1040 to get back the extra tax on or before April 15th of 1980. Which is the running of the statute of limitations for tax purposes. 77, obviously it's 81, but you have a little bit more time. In 78, you have all the way till April 15 of 1982. On the other hand, if you did claim too much as housing allowance, you should also file an amended return and pay the tax, the extra tax in the amount by which you underpaid your taxes for those same 3 years. You are vulnerable to a claim for refund for any of those 3 years according to the same schedule. So up till April 15, 1980, you are vulnerable. In addition, it's possible to have an extended statute of limitations favoring the government, not favoring the taxpayer, but favoring the government. If you understated your income by more than 25%, it can be up to a 6-year statute of limitations. And this could very well have happened depending on just what you did do with the housing allowance, how much more you took than you should have. But generally, you can feel fairly secure about not being audited or additional tax claimed. As to 1975 and prior years, you should be pretty well home free now. 76, you will as of April 15, 1980, and so on. Okay, then just to make the point on page 3, we are concerned with future policy and practice, and that is the percentage or actual amount, whether the seminary should have a policy setting housing allowance for those not living in seminary-owned housing based upon percentage, or should it have an actual amount based upon individual consideration. We'll talk about those things as soon as we have talked about the earlier part of this outline. We'll also talk about reporting the allowance on your 1040, how you should be doing it and how you shouldn't be doing it, and also how the seminary should be reporting as to whether it's on a W-2 or a 1099 and whether it's reporting anything at all. Let's hold that whole latter block off until we're sure that we're talking about the same things when it comes to housing allowance and what's allowed and what's not.
Okay, let's see the hands of those who want to speak. May I just get a number of hands first? Bob Herber, Elmer, Clyde, Richard. Okay, we'll start then with Bob Herber, Andy Bartell, Donald Knight, Clyde, Mr. Richard Plant.
Last one, number 4, is that 3?
Yes, sir.
That is all. 40% or whatever the consumption is, 2.5 to 45 now, excludable percentage, apply also to the additional money we have paid to summer school teachers?
It should, and if the resolution isn't clear enough, it ought to, because you are being paid by the seminary for that summer school. Now,
supplement the salary.
Correct, yes, but it is a salary from the seminary. So let's contrast with the fact that if you were to go out to my congregation as a guest speaker and be paid a honorarium of some kind, I think you all know that that, while it's called an honorarium, is taxable income, but your percentage wouldn't apply against that because it's being paid to you by somebody else than your employer. So, but I would say anything you do for the seminary, anything that you do for the seminary and are paid for, will be subject to that, and we need to be sure that the resolution is clear enough. I have no doubt that the resolution would do that if we had an argument about it, but I don't like arguments, so we'll make sure.
It just uses the word salary, as I recall. 45% of salary.
Yeah.
While we're on it, if I could ask one more question, this applies to those who own their own home. In addition to the salary, we also get a housing subsidy. And I would maintain, and I'd like to hear this verified, that in addition to the 45% now of our salary that we could exclude, we can also add, right onto the top, the whatever it is, it varies, but take, for example, $230 or $250 a month housing subsidy, which we receive in lieu of a faculty house. Now, I think that can be maintained, but I'd like
yeah.
to be able to
well. I don't think you can take it in addition. To me, that's that same formula kind of setting of compensation to essentially equate the person with the sem-owned house with a person who does not live in a sem-owned house. So that you take your cash compensation, including the housing subsidy, add it up, come up with a gross number, and apply 45% to that.
Well, that's what I've been advised.
Okay. Let me turn it around and tell you why we both may be right, or either one of us may be wrong, but in your case, my case is a safe way of doing it and won't be questioned. Your case is the risky case, risky way of proceeding, in which case you might be tapped by the service, who then says, once you calculate that by 45% of the non-housing subsidy cash compensation plus all of the subsidy, you're up to 65%, which is unreasonable in relation to compensation and is too much. We won't allow it. That's what you're risking. The seminary's not risking a thing. You are, that you may be caught. All of you are, but the seminary needs to consider that kind of a question when it comes to 45%. Is 45% too high? Well, we have decided that it is not, or that there is an excellent argument considering how poorly you're paid, that 45% of how poorly you're paid is still only a reasonable amount for housing purposes. Now, if you doubled your salary and took 45% of it, I could guarantee you would be all exposed to unreasonable in relation to compensation. So we both may be right. Mine's the safer way. Yours is the riskier way. And I suppose that is a legitimate issue in writing the resolution as to how we want to do it.
May I just interject a comment of something you said, Phil, on this BHE policy? The BHE has established a dollar amount for faculty, for housing, what they've called a housing allowance for faculty people, depending on their marital status and the number of children. It's set at $275 a month for faculty person with children at home or supported by the parent, $235 a month, I believe, for couples, and $190 for single people. That's set by the BHE. Now, what that means, it seems to me, in terms of setting salary, let's suppose we propose to call a professor who's married and has two children, and the salary, just to use a ballpark figure, assume he's a full professor, about ready to retire, at the top of our salary ladder. So we set his salary at 15,000, 10 maybe be more reasonable. Let's say $15,000. And we offer him a house on campus, that's the way this would be offered, $15,000 plus a home on campus. Or we say to him, if you want to buy your own, we provide $275 a month, which is $3,300. Okay. At the end of the year, if he takes this latter option, at the end of the year, the business office gives him a 1099, and it will report this figure as his salary. I think that's pertinent to your question.
Right. And it's
45% now of this figure, as I understand it, that is allowable.
Right. And we'll be holding this matter of how much they should be reporting and how to a little bit later. I understand they have been reporting on the 1099, this full amount. We'll get back to that, leave that as an open question. But at this point, the issue is, do you take 45% of the 18,300, or do you take 45% of the $15,000 plus the $3,300?
Right.
And I regard that at the present time as an open issue, but I have to point out that if the percentage is too high, everyone who goes that latter route is risking a tax audit and a claim for refund in the future years. To my knowledge, the BHE has never intended that it be applied to mean 45% of this plus this and to qualify for the housing. Number one, the BHE hasn't any authority. Only your Board of Control has authority to establish the allowance. And to my knowledge, the board has never established a housing allowance based upon that formula. Still, of course, I think arguments can be made, and I don't want to give away any of your tax cases if you want to make a tax case out of that point. Okay, but I have made a note that as we work on this, we need to consider those two interpretations and determine which of them probably is the best policy and practice for the seminary.
Just to pick up what you said earlier, you also said on summer school, say if the prof got $1,200 extra, he'd actually get $19,500 on his 1099.
Yeah.
You said earlier, in your judgment, the 45% would be taken.
I want to leave that 1099
right.
off. You
all
finally
right.
come down to a bottom number, gross by all means, salary, summer school, special work. I don't know to what extent you have special committees and you compensate somebody, but anything like that.
Pay them for as little as possible.
Right, right. Anything like that, though, you come down to the bottom line, the biggest number you can that the seminary paid in cash compensation, and that's where you begin working from.
Okay, let's get the other questions. Elmer was next.
In the middle of page one, you list new furniture and housing and new furnishings and furniture as excludable for people who live in standalone housing, but on page 2 in A, that's not repeated.
Yep. My mistake. It ought to be included. It definitely ought to be included. Furniture and furnishings. Yeah. The only thing you'd have to do is to check their own percentage and so forth, but sure.
The other question, the main question, is I've had furnishings defined to be differently. For example, couch, yes, drapes, no.
That's why I put furniture in furnishings. It's an easy escape. According to the tax law as I know it, you are entitled to use to justify your exclusion everything that goes into maintaining your home. Draperies, rugs, whether they're, wall-to-wall carpeting or not, furniture, the sofa, the chair, the pots, the pans, the toaster, and on and on and on. If you spend the money, that's being spent for housing.
Plus repairs to
refrigerators and repairs to the house itself. There's been some question as to whether you can pay your maid from... there are a certain number of questions you recognize I must leave to each of you to evaluate yourself. But there's no question about the furniture and furnishings and interpreted broadly.
Okay.
question about the furniture and furnishings and interpret it broadly. Agreed.
If you go beyond that, lose it.
Correct. That's why I put down there the lesser of at the bottom of page one. If you, and that's one of the reasons why the 35% and then the 37.5% have been questioned, and why indeed the whole notion of percentage has been questioned, and why that we'll get back to that as an open question, as to whether you ought to do something more to raise that limitation. But you're quite right. It is the lesser of the two. That will hit particularly hard for those of you who might buy a house, and let's say that you can afford a substantial down payment, and you spend 25% of your salary in 1 year as the down payment and finance the other 75%. That 25% of your cash compensation will be available in that year. Let's say you buy a house in 1979 and you pay 25% of the value down and finance through a bank loan the 75%. So you take that 25%, let's say, of a $60,000 house, and you have qualified already before you start on taxes and insurance and utilities for $15,000. Now you add all the rest of it and you come up to $25,000, which not only exceeds your percentage allowance, exceeds your whole salary. But because you spent it in 79, you can't use that in 80 or 81 or 82. So you have to be smart when you're buying the house, and you put down as little as possible of your own money. How do you do that? If you've got a friend or a neighbor or a family member that can lend the money to you, you borrow the down payment, you pay the 25% down, borrow the 75% from a bank, and pay back your friend or neighbor or family member at the rate of $1,000 a year, and you keep on excluding that extra $1,000. And you don't even have to pay interest, just the principal alone. And by that simple process, guaranteed process, you have converted what would have been entirely lost to the extent that you didn't use it in 79 into a recurring amount qualifying for the exclusion. Now, when I say guaranteed, it assumes that you go about it in the right way. You give the person a note. You maybe put a second mortgage on the house. You actually make the payments, interest and principal, even if it's a family member. But once you do just those mechanical things, you've guaranteed that you have done yourself some real good, as opposed to the nice guy who just dips into his savings account and spends that $15,000 and puts it into his house. He gets a big exclusion, full exclusion in 79, but after that he drops back down to whatever he's spending on utilities and the bank loan. Okay. I don't know. I went over that very quickly, and we can come back to it, but maybe we can reserve those kinds of things for those of you who might be candidates for that.
Yeah, I heard the other day, I don't know if it's just rumor, but maybe somebody here knows, one of our vicars came back from a congregation in California where they are alleged to pay the pastor a higher housing allowance than they pay salary. Mark Hoffman, right?
Cal Nevada Hawaii has some kind of a program by which they are trying to set aside amounts which will then be used for housing. The typical case of the minister who is living in a parsonage but wants to get out of that situation and get into a case where he can have equity in his own house and all the benefits that go along with owning a house, and come over and see mine with only half the paint scraped off of it, and we'll question the benefits. But they're trying to do that so that what it would be an amount which is set aside. I have questions about it. I don't know that it has been submitted to the service or passed muster. So anytime, look, just put down a rule of thumb. Anytime that you are claiming a housing allowance equal to half or more of your salary, just put in the back of your mind that you're likely going to be challenged if your return is pulled for an audit. You may win. You may get away with it, but anytime you go over 50%, anytime you get up to 120%, I can guarantee that somehow that computer is going to say something about your return.
tell them that fit on council's advice. We're getting fighting the clock a little bit, and I have seen hands from John Fox, Roger Meyer, and David Daniel. Perhaps we could hear these three men, and then you wanted to finish.
Yeah, we want to get back to that latter part. Correct. She was wrong. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And if any of you are ever told that, just recognize the fact that Internal Revenue Service agents, auditing agents, can also be wrong. She was wrong. This is under Section 107 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is under the section, the part of the code dealing with exclusions. And that's why we will talk in a little bit about the reporting of it, both by the seminary and by you. You do not refer to it because it isn't there. It is an exclusion. You only report your includable income. It is an exclusion. You don't deduct it. You aren't subject to any limitations the way some deductions are. So she was wrong. Don't do it that way, and don't accept anybody telling you to do it that way. Well, let me, that may be right or partially right, but again, let's be sure that we have the right vocabulary. What I'm talking about here is using those expenditures to qualify for the exclusion, not deduct it the way I indicate here. I'm not deducting it here. You're using it to qualify for the exclusion. But second, part of your telephone expense may very well be deductible as a business expense. But that would be the kind it would be, the reason it would be deductible. Yeah. And again, each of you will have to evaluate yourself the extent, if at all, that you use your phone at home for business purposes. You know, we've got kind of a strange situation in that the clergyman, the minister, whether he's employed by a congregation or by the seminary or district or whatever, is treated as self-employed. You pay the self-employment tax and you don't withhold from income tax from his compensation and remit it. Nevertheless, you are employees of this seminary. You have no argument to make that you are not any, that you are anything but a common law employee. Now, therefore, not a common law employee, a common law employee, Ralph. Therefore, I question whether you can deduct expenditures as business expenses for what you do for the seminary. Because if you use your telephone, you are not in business for yourself. Now, I am truly self-employed. I'm a partner in a law firm, and I am self-employed. I can deduct those kind of expenses if I pay them out of my own salary. But you're not, even though you're self-employed for Social Security purposes. Again, a lot of that may go over your head and not be of much meaning to you, but don't reach conclusions that may not be justified. If you, as a clergyman, you may also be self-employed in the sense that you are available for filling vacancies or whatever, and you may buy a gown. You may have your own gown. You may buy books in order that you can keep up in that part of your, quote, business, end quote. Those expenses can be deducted. So those are not connected necessarily with your employment here, but rather your being a minister of the gospel, your business of being a minister of the gospel. Again, we're going a little bit afield, but I thought it was important on that point. What other?
Roger Myers.
Yes.
Right or wrong, I don't know if it's a possibility. Seward, they handle that. They allow individuals to petition the Board of Control for the year coming, not for the past.
Right.
So, like in December of 79, you can petition the Board of Control there if you work for them, to allow a higher percentage than what the board flatly stated.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's use Roger's point as a jump off for that part of what's the outline on page 3. Professor Mathias has also made that point, and it's one of the reasons it's on here. The question is, as stated there, not too clear terminology, is whether to use the percentage method or use an actual amount which is based upon individual or personal considerations. To flesh that out a little bit, should the Board of Control have a policy that says 45% of your salary if you don't live in SEM-owned housing is housing allowance, and 7.5% of your compensation is housing allowance if you do live in SEM-owned housing? Or should it do what Roger described and send out a worksheet to each of you in December and request that you get it back to the business office before January 1st, indicating how much you anticipate spending in 1980, for example, for housing purposes? The latter better allows for individual needs and practices. But in that strength, there is also an inherent weakness. And I'm not telling you this as a lawyer because it's none of my business to say it as a lawyer, but I'm doing it because I'm addressing the subject. For those of you who get a salary of $12,000 but whose wife is independently wealthy and you choose to live in Ladue and to pay all the money, including the taxes, which in many cases may be more than what you pay, what you would pay for housing if you lived in Brentwood, for that person, that method rewards that kind of personal situation. It may also reward an extravagant living style, because this professor and this professor, both of whom draw the same salary, one may choose to live in Ladue and save nothing, and the other may choose to live in Brentwood and save a good deal. And it seems to me, and I've only pointed this out to Ralph and I pointed out to you, and the board has to consider it, are those kinds of built-in inequities for the best interest of the institution. Now, on the other side of it, again, in order that I can present this as objectively as possible, doing what Roger has described better permits each individual situation to be more accurately reflected than will any overall percentage. So there is at this time, again, one of those open issues which will be dealt with by the board. The question is whether to go one way or to go another way. The percentage, but you can exceed it. Well, that's, yeah, that, as you described it. Now, the latter two, if I can just touch on those, and we can round this off and then finish with any questions or comments. We've already dealt with the reporting of the allowance on your 1040. You should not report any part of the allowance as long as you can justify that because you've spent that amount up to the maximum percentage. If you spend less than the maximum percentage, you are obligated to include in the part of the return dealing with other compensation the difference. Okay, if you follow me, if you apply a percentage times your compensation, which produces a housing allowance of, let's say, $8,000, and you only spend five, you have to take the $3,000 that was that you did not spend for housing, and you have to add it back to your other compensation as other compensation. Why do you go through those gymnastics? The reason is that the seminary should have been all these years only reporting the net amount, so that instead of 18.3, and let's assume that our question is resolved in my favor. I like to do it that way, whether I'm right or not. And Louis, so you got 18.3, and you apply 45% times that, and I didn't bring my calculator, and without it, I can't do mathematics in my head anymore. But whatever number that comes to, it produces a bottom line number of something in the range of $10,000. The seminary should only ever have been reporting that $10,000 on the 1099. The Internal Revenue Service says so. It says, please don't confuse us by reporting the gross amount. Only report the includable amount. And it is on a 1099, although there is an open question, and we are asking for a ruling from the service as to whether they want a 1099 or a W-2. There have been some changes in procedures, and it's uncertain. Southern California District has received a bulletin from the service indicating maybe a W-2 is the right way, but put that aside for the moment. The seminary will be reporting to you on either a W-2 or a 1099 only the net amount. That's why it then becomes your responsibility, if you don't spend the housing allowance, to include that in other income as unused housing allowance. You actually say that, unused housing allowance, blank dollars. That's the right way. Again, you're going to have CPAs and H&R Block type people, and maybe even our friendly IRS agent who had John's return on her desk, saying, hey, that's not right. And you can say, hey, it is too, and if you don't believe it, we'll make a case of it. Okay, those are all of those points. Ralph, particularly, I think it would be useful if we can get comments on that percentage or actual amount. I think that will be helpful to you.
We still have one speaker left over.
Okay,
I'd like to honor Dave Daniel first, and then we'll come back to that. Dave?
This question has to do with purchasing a house and the down payment and including it borrowing. First of all, if you borrow the money for a down payment from a relative without paying the interest, I understand that in the past the IRS has looked quite askance at that and said you should be paying interest. Can that borrowing from a family member be interest free?
Yes, it can, and this has been an area developing in the law. Number one, they can't tell you to pay interest. You and your relative can strike whatever deal you want, including that you don't pay interest. What can happen is that the service can say to your relative, there is an imputed interest, according to a section, I think it's 583 of the Internal Revenue Code, equal to at least 5% or 6%, and we're going to treat you as getting taxable compensation. Now, go with me with how this is going to develop. You don't pay them interest, but you pay them $1,000 a year back on the loan. The service says, hey, 6% of the whole amount is interest. We're going to impute it. Even though you didn't pay interest, we're going to tax you on it. That's imputed interest. However, there have been some cases just in this last year that indicate that indeed for all tax purposes, relatives and friends can make interest-free loans to one another and that the imputed interest rules may not apply. It's an open question. My recommendation to you would be if you can get a deal with no interest, don't pay interest. You don't deduct it, obviously, because you don't pay it, but neither does your relative include any part of that payment as compensation.
Secondly, does that relative have to be living outside the home? Why? In other words, a wife can make a loan to a husband or a husband to a wife.
I would say that there is no reason that you cannot work that kind of a deal. There are a whole lot of stranger things that are done for tax purposes between husband and wife than something like that.
The third thing, in figuring the first year's down payment, would it be wise to include the net proceeds from another house as reinvested according to that particular section and use that as a reinvestment? In other words,
Yeah, I'd be very leery of giving you a general answer to that kind of question. I'm always happy to talk about a specific situation, but when you get into that kind of an arrangement with the sale of another house and how you should apply the proceeds, whether you pay it down and use that or borrow, I'd rather deal with that on a one-by-one basis and really be sure that I've got the facts straight in my mind before I give a general answer. I would say there is good economic planning that can come, good economic results that can come from tax planning in that area. Let me say that much and stop there.
I think we will go until 3:15, but we'll be running into real trouble if we go beyond that. I've recognized the hand of Dick Schultz and Ellen Matthias. Dick, please.
I think real quickly, I'm having a little trouble figuring out how seminary owned housing we exclude up to 7.5%. Seminary reports the full salary.
Well, no. No, let's back up a moment. You live in seminary-owned housing, and let's assume that we have a resolution that says 7.5% of your base cash salary is housing. Okay, now the question is, on what do you spend an amount equal to that? Insurance premiums on your homeowner's insurance, buying new furniture, buying new furnishings, you may buy some light bulbs, you might buy some fuses, you might do things, you may call somebody at maintenance, I don't know how much you get away with here, probably just as well I don't, but there may be times in which you may replace a broken window rather than wait for maintenance to come around and do it.
Utilities,
of course, yes, and given utility expenses, maybe 7.5% is inadequate. We'll have to look at that too. That, yes, sir. At least that is going to be my recommendation, and I assume that the business office will follow it, but I don't know.
The board was under the impression already in July that when we talked about this, that we would be changing our reporting processes to you, that we've been doing it wrong all these years. But we may have to work out some details on this.
Right.
We can always report some of these to you before the end of the year, I should think. Let's recognize Elmer. Please, Elmer.
Yeah. On this matter of percentage versus individual amount, I would encourage you to go into the individual amount and the percentage, at least give the option, because either with the same price housing and the same kind of salaries we have around here, housing needs can vary. It all depends on the size of your down payment. Some people put down a small down payment. Some people, some of us can't qualify for the small down payments because of our salary. So we have to get a large down payment and our housing varies, costs vary. In a given year, you may be planning a remodeling and you can request an increase of $1,000 or $2,000 in that year. That would be an advantage too. So I would strongly encourage individual, at least an option.
That's one of the proposals that the board deferred action on. In the meantime, adopting this 45% figure, and I take it we've asked Phil to advise us on the board on that matter.
Well, it essentially it's going to come down to a policy judgment as to whether there's any felt risk of perhaps hard feelings between faculty members because of a lifestyle that can be rewarded by that, and what the point that Elmer makes is very valid. That's all I can say is that that's the one side of it, but there is another side. It will not be for me to judge or advise you on the realm.
The overwhelming majority of us live in synodically owned homes on campus or right next to it. In an individualized approach, would that apply to us too, or would you recommend a standardized figure for us on an individualized approach?
No, I would think it would, in order to not create any more categories than necessary, if you go the individualized route, it ought to apply to both those living in sem-owned housing and those not living in sem-owned housing. Because, again, on a lesser scale, the same considerations can apply. I want to throw out all the furniture I have in my living room and dining room and buy all new, and I ought to be able to take that into consideration for 1980, that kind of question. Much less, but still, it's there.
I would like to get an expression of faculty's sentiment on that individualized versus the percentage approach to that. You would not have to get your opinion on it today, nor even in our next faculty meeting. And in fact, if a committee would like to chew on it a little longer, perhaps we could assign it to the Faculty Welfare Committee, perhaps then to meet further with Phil. But I do think the board will lean very heavily on what you want on this matter. And I would urge us to find a mechanism by which we can decide as a faculty what we would like and then ask the board to do that. The board's meeting schedule calls for it to meet September 21, 22, and then again in the third weekend of November. Do you have any comments on moving, since we have run out of time, any of you have any suggestions as to how we might carry this forward? Because I think it's a matter of some importance. Richard?
I would urge consideration of a realistic housing allowance for those who own their own homes.
Yes, that's a very serious
good.
Very. Distinct from this, but the board is working on that one too. This $275 or $235 a month that you're getting is totally unrealistic. You should not rent Clayton. What did you rent for that? I don't know, one room apartment. A suggestion for moving this forward, would you please? Does anyone have one? Otherwise, I'll simply do it by asking the Faculty Welfare Committee to take it under its purview and report it to a business meeting of the faculty as soon as possible. Is that agreeable with you? We'll do it that way. And one more question, Dan.
Just real quick, how many years do I keep those Zoom records to be safe?
Six. Seven will make it a little bit better. 6 years because of that exposure to a 6-year statute of limitations. You add on the extra one and it's a little margin of error. I keep my records forever. I have no intention of giving them away, even if I have to go to one of these rental storage places to keep them ultimately. I'm just not going to do away with them. But 7 years if you decide that you don't want that paper laying around anymore.
Thank you very much, Phil. I'm sure I speak for all of you in suggesting that if we have additional questions in the areas where we were today and would like to have Phil come back again, perhaps near income tax time, Phil, you would probably be willing to do that. Would you?
That's what I'd be asking.
Okay. Thank you very much, Phil.